We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning, and welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're very happy to have back on the program once again two guests. They've been with us before to talk about companion animal care. They're both clinical assistant professors at the U of I College of Veterinary Medicine, Drs. Julia Whittington and Julie Byron. And we can take a wide range of questions. I assume that we'll be spending most of our time talking about routine care for cats and dogs. So if you want to talk about that, illness issues, about diet, nutrition, about you know, animals, how they change once they go from infants to adolescents to senior citizens, any and all of that, I'm sure that the two of them would do their best to help you out and give you an answer. So the number, 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send along your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here once again.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
We were just talking here about wildlife, and that is, I know, is Julia? The two Julies. That's a particular area of specialty of yours.
Exactly.
And that you at your clinic have a rescue operation, essentially, if people find a wild animal that's injured, that they can bring the animal to you. And maybe you also might want to talk about, well, how exactly do you do that? Because you don't want to cause further injury to the animal.
Exactly. Or to yourself, yeah. Of course. You know, yes. Certainly this is an exciting time of year for the wildlife clinic. We see a lot of migratory animals that we wouldn't necessarily see otherwise. For instance, we just received a white pelican in the other day, and that's not an animal you're going to find in central Illinois very often. Mm-hmm. And most likely it was migrating through on its way to wintering grounds. But what we need to understand is certainly along those pathways, some of which are extensive, there's always the risk that these animals will encounter something that leads to a traumatic injury. Certainly some of them just succumb to the energy tasking that it takes to make that migration. So we'll find hummingbirds that are simply found down on the ground, just simply fatigued and exhausted from their trip. So if those animals are encountered, we want to encourage people to bring them to the wildlife medical clinic. There's no cost to the public to do that. And what we'll do is we'll triage those animals and take every measure that we feasibly can to get them back to the point where they can be on their way.
Okay. Well, if you say, for example, maybe there is an animal that's just completely shagged, and otherwise they're healthy, how can you – so then the thing to do would be just leave them alone, let them rest, and probably they'd be okay. Mm-hmm. How do you know if this is something you even want to get involved with?
Well, that's a good question. You know, certainly we see a lot of animals that people find maybe right next to your beautiful picture window. And the likelihood is the animal had an impact with your picture window and is stunned on the ground. Some of those animals need advanced critical care because they have trauma to their brain. Others, by the time you get them to our clinic, are alert and ready to fly away. Really, the best thing is to let us check them out. We will certainly try to release them back to the site where they were found. So, you know, I know some people are very interested in being a part of that process from beginning to end, and we're grateful for them and try to work with them. So if an animal's found on the ground and it's not behaving normally or it has an obvious injury, then we would recommend that they be brought to us. Certainly, you have to assess what potential risk that animal has for you in handling it. All wild animals, I don't care if it's a cotton-tailed rabbit or a red-tailed hawk or a coyote, they have the means to protect themselves. And even when they're sick and injured, that means is available to them. So we always want to use caution. And if there's any concern on the finder's part about whether or not they can safely acquire that animal, they should err on the side of not and contact somebody who is familiar with that species. There are several wildlife trappers, wildlife professionals who can be contacted, and then sometimes animal control or the conservation police are able to assist us as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have a couple callers. Let's talk with them, and we'll start with someone in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. I hope that you can give me some guidance or just sort of like, well, from our experience, if the following thing happens. I have four cats, and one black lab. And the problem is with one cat. It's a female neutered lab. She would be called a runt. She's fully grown but very small. And unfortunately, I also have a male who's a beautiful animal, but he's mean. And for a period of time, the standard procedure of all the cats going there was pretty normal. Then all of a sudden, the black one, who happens to be my favorite one, stopped doing the things that she was doing, and I had to search throughout the house. Finally found her in a small area we use for drying and washing clothes. She was up at the very top, and I got her down and let her down, and she was right back up. And then I started just paying attention to her, and I found out that she runs everywhere, even a short place, sort of 10 feet away, runs up to second floor, runs. And I started thinking perhaps Sammy, the mean cat, may have done something to her, but I couldn't have anything to pin it on. But every time I carried her in my arms and I was around him, 10 feet, she started growling, hissing, and doing things like that. So I'm pretty sure he's done something traumatic to her. Then yesterday morning, luckily, I saw him attack another cat, female cat. It's about his size. She won't take any stuff from him, so she smacked him back. So I'm thinking maybe I'm a problem boy, and I'm concerned about, I don't want to put him down or anything. Find somebody, but take him in, or maybe, you know, on a farm or someplace like that. I was just wondering if that sounds a sensible thing to do. He's old, and he's been neutered, and he's outside a lot, and he's a natural-born fighter, extremely intelligent, and is practically afraid of nothing. And I just wondered if my scenario seems reasonable to you. And if so, I'll have to make the decision about what to do about Sammy, but I was just wondering if you think that would fit the facts, so to speak.
Well, a lot of times in older animals, their tolerance of younger animals sort of diminishes somewhat. It's not very surprising to see the dynamics, especially if these two cats have, you know, the smaller one and Sammy have lived together for at least, you know, the majority of their lives, that
to see
the older one start to change his behavior, be less tolerant. One of the things that you may want to do, and you may have already done this, is get both Sammy and the younger cat checked out by your vet, because Sammy may be intolerant of the other cats because he's having some discomfort from arthritis or from some other health things. And we do have some options for pain medication for arthritis in aging cats. They're a little bit different than the ones from dogs. Cats don't tolerate some of the traditional medications as well, but there are some that can be used. And it may be that if, you know, just like a person who's experiencing a lot of pain, maybe sort of grumpy and out of sorts, that may help, especially if you feel like it's really changed in the last, you know, few months. I think that that's something that's worth doing. And also maybe get the other one checked out and just make sure that she's okay and she's not having any problems or injuries that may have occurred. And it may make Sammy a much more pleasant animal for his housemates. So that's one of the first things I would consider doing. The other thing is, if I realize with the weather getting colder, it's not as ideal to have him outside as much. But, you know, if he enjoys being outside and it's a safe environment and he's used to it, to allow him that time to kind of get some of his sort of hunting instincts and exploratory, you know, energies out a little bit, so he's sort of not feeling as cooped up in the house. That's something. And I certainly, you know, it's a very controversial issue as to letting cats in, you know, indoor cats outside and things like that. And I'm not against it. I know there are lots of people who are. I think it's a very individual choice, and it has a lot to do with the personality of the animal as well as the environment that your home is in. You know, if you're in an area that's more rural with some property, not close to a busy road, that kind of thing, you know, letting them out for a little while during the day is fine. You know, I live in a suburb and I let mine out, but they really don't go far beyond my patio. They don't really even go in the grass, and they're happy doing it. And then they go back in. They spend 10 minutes out and they go back in. And, you know, small things like that can actually do a lot to reduce their stress level. And that may help some of the conflicts. I think that if you feel in the end like you can't manage this, it might be worth considering trying to find an environment where he would be happier maybe as an individual animal, as, you know, the only cat.
Yeah.
But I would consider, especially if it's changed recently, to get him checked out for pain, because that absolutely can make him a grumpy guy.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do that. Thanks a lot for your help.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Well, we'll go on to another caller. This is Wellington's, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. We have a cat that's about 12 years old, and we discovered here a year or so ago it was diabetic. And I was feeding it wellness. Well, prior to that time, we'd been feeding it science diet for older cats. Well, when I took it to the vet and we realized it was diabetic because it was drinking ridiculous amounts of water, that they put it on it, said that cats respond better to diet than dogs and people do. And they put it on wellness food. And within like a week's time, this cat was total revision of its behavior. It just become like its old self again. However, that company has been sold to Procter & Gamble, and I understand they're making it just kind of more of a commercial product now. So do you have any recommendations for other high-protein cat foods or cat foods that are specifically for diabetic cats?
Yes, actually, there are two very good ones out there that are specifically formulated for diabetic cats. And a lot of research has gone into their development. One of them is a Purina product called DM. It used to be called diabetic management, but now it's dietary management, I think is what the DM stands for. But it's a high-protein, low-carbohydrate food. It comes in both canned and dry varieties. There's another diet called MD, that's it. And it's made by Hill's Science Diet. It's a prescription diet, which is their line of prescription foods for animals with like kidney disease and liver disease and that sort of thing. And it's called M/D. And that is another high protein, low carb diet. I believe it also comes in dry and canned. I know it's dry. I think it's canned food as well. And both of those are very good products. Another option, if your cat is not interested in eating either of those, although I've rarely seen any that don't, most cats love it, is considering kitten food even. But I think either the MD or the DM are probably better diets in that they are specifically formulated for diabetic cats. And they have antioxidant supplements and some things like that. But cats do very well on this type of diet. Some that have been insulin dependent, we were actually able to get off of insulin on the diet.
Well, this one has never been on insulin.
Okay.
It just did a complete turnaround in its activities and its behavior. Like I said, just after a week on this, we feed it like, you know, a third of a can in the morning, a third of a can at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it pre-feeds dry, whatever. But this Purina and the whatever, are they readily available in this area?
So these are two products that are part of the prescription diet lines of the two companies of Purina and Hill's. And Hill's is the company that makes Science Diet.
Right.
So they aren't available at pet stores. They are available generally from your veterinarian, and they're also available online with a veterinarian prescription, which basically means the vet just faxes them something and you get it. You can order it online. I would speak to your vet, because even if your vet doesn't actually carry either of the diets, many times they can special order small amounts specifically for you. But I have a diabetic cat who's on DM, and I was able to get her off of insulin. I mean, I'm a big fan of the high-protein, low-carb diet, and there's a fair amount of scientific research backing it up.
Well, apparently, would these cats be better off if you fed them this from the very beginning?
Well, that's somewhat controversial, and it's not really been well evaluated as far as research goes. I think, you know, we think about diabetic cats as sort of similar to people who have type 2 diabetes, whereas diabetic dogs are sort of like people who have type 1 diabetes, in that diabetic cats, weight, obesity, activity level, inflammatory conditions, those things are very intimately related with their diabetes and the development of insulin dependence and their diabetic state, similar to people with type 2 diabetes. And actually, cats have become a model in a lot of research projects. Much of the research actually is going on here at U of I, looking at the impact of nutrition and inflammation and things like that on insulin resistance and the development of type 2 diabetes. And so cats are actually a research model for that. And when we look at our patients who develop diabetes, they do tend to be heavier. They do tend to be more sedentary as far as cats go, whereas dogs, it's more of an immune process or a genetically predetermined process like a type 1 diabetic person. So I actually feel that diet can be a big impact. However, I think not necessarily the high protein, low carb diet is going to prevent it so much. Some people certainly do put their pets on that diet, but what that actually does is the high protein diet tends to keep their weight down. And especially if you are careful about the volume they eat, you can certainly overfeed them and make them fat even with that diet. But it does help to improve lean body mass and reduce fat mass. And so because of that, there may be some reduction in the risk of it. But I don't feel that the majority of cats necessarily need to be on a specifically high-protein diet, although most cat foods are pretty high in protein already. It's really, I think, related to the ratio of protein to carbs and that sort of thing.
Well, I did learn one thing that, you know, that run-of-the-mill, over-the-counter, so to speak, cat foods are really high in ash and grains, which apparently are not the best, management for your pet.
Well, they are, you know, cats are, you know, carnivores, and generally their bodies are not as adapted to manage the kind of carbohydrates that we put in all of our pet foods. But honestly, the pet food industry has invested a very large amount of money in research and researching pet foods. And I think if you look at some of the bigger companies and look at the quality of their pet foods, they're actually quite good. And there is an actual governing board that evaluates the quality of pet food and regulates specific nutrients and things like that that are in it. So they're all sort of vetted through that prior to being put on the market. But, I think whether you put a cat on a high-protein, low-carb diet for its entire life, even if it's not diabetic, is sort of one of those things that people kind of think might be a good idea, but really there's not been enough specific research about it. But certainly a diabetic animal, I think that's a general standard of care recommendation nowadays.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions are welcome. Here we're talking this morning in this hour focused about companion animal care. Our guests are Julie Byron and Juliet Whittington. They're both clinical assistant professors in the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. And whatever questions you might have, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Prior to about maybe 10 years ago or so, I guess I felt like I'm not even sure I had heard about cats being diabetic. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention. Is it something that either there's more of it, or is it something that it's just maybe the level of awareness is greater than it was?
I think it probably is both, to tell you the truth. I think some of it is because our pet population has also grown in body mass along with our human population. We're seeing a lot more heavy, obese animals, dogs and cats. And along with that comes the increase in the diseases that go along with that, arthritic problems and such, and things like diabetes. And so I think that's part of it. I think our pets are living longer than they used to. And I think people are making medical decisions about their pets that are similar to the way they may make decisions about themselves or family members, and that they know that those things are available like insulin and that sort of thing. And so they're willing to consider trying it rather than just saying, okay, the cat has diabetes, it's time to let him go and, put him down. But I think that people are more willing to consider medicating their pets. There is an obesity epidemic among dogs and cats. We are aware of that. I think that the veterinary community, as well as pet food companies and animal health divisions of companies like pharmaceutical companies and such, are doing a better job of sort of just disseminating information to the general public. And so people actually will come in to see us and already know several things about their animal's health that they've sort of picked up on the web and that kind of thing. So,
okay. Well, let's take another call here. Oakwood is the caller. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Yes.
We have a black lab that has an eating problem. She's an undersized dog. She was picked up the litter by one of the major breeders in Illinois, but she turned out to be too short, so she's 2 inches shorter than the standard lab. And when she eats, we've tried raising her bowl to various levels. When she eats, she often immediately throws up during the eating, after the eating, but it's a constant problem.
Is this something she's done her whole life, or since you've acquired
her? She's done it for quite a while, and it seems to be getting worse instead of better as she gets older.
Well, some animals and Labradors, because they love their food, as I'm sure you are aware of, they eat very, very quickly, and it's almost so fast that they sort of overexpand their stomach too quickly, or some of the food will sort of get caught in their esophagus and they may regurgitate or vomit. But one of the things that we've done to try and help with that is to actually slow their eating down a little bit. And there are bowls and things like that you can buy that have like big lumps of plastic or nubble things in the middle of them. So they actually have to kind of eat the kibble around those, and it slows them down a little bit. Honestly, I found one of the best ideas is you just take a plastic food bowl and flip it upside down, because that the bowl shape on the underside, it's just kind of a little rim around the edge, and you can just put the kibble in that rim and you've got this mound in the middle. And so they have to kind of eat around the edge, and that oftentimes will slow them down. And so I agree. I think the idea of raising her food bowl is very helpful. It's also reduces probably the stress on her neck as she's getting older and stuff as well. But I think that considering trying to do something like that, you know, some people will put rocks or tennis balls or things like that in the middle of the bowl. And put the food around it. The only thing I would just be sure about is that whatever it is that is you're going to put in the middle of the bowl to slow her down is not something that is small enough for her to actually get in her mouth and swallow. So just put something big in there or something she can chew up. But yeah, if you even take a plastic food bowl, flip it upside down and try and slow her down a little bit. I also have had some clients who have fed them only half their meal and then wait 15 minutes and feed them the other half, that kind of thing. So
she'll actually, we do put water in their food so that they, I got two labs, and they both, as you know, labs eat fast. They both eat fast, but she, you know, sometimes the first bite, the first gulp she takes, she'll throw that up.
Have you talked to your vet about this?
Yes, we have, okay. And she suggested some of the things you're suggesting. Very same thing, you know, the bowl is designed to slow them down. We just haven't done that yet. We haven't found the bowl yet, frankly.
Thank you
very much. This is verifying what we think.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add on to that.
No, there are several websites you can go to where you can order these bowls as well, or most pet stores will actually carry them. Big chain pet stores will probably carry bowls like that too. So
not meaning to suggest it's a problem in this case, but I'm thinking generally about some of the things you said before about maybe the animals being too heavy. I guess there's two parts of that. Part of it is, are we creating opportunities for them to get exercise? Which is probably easier for dogs since they got to go outside than it is for cats if the cats spend all their time inside. But I guess I wonder a little bit too about the chances that people could be overfeeding. And I guess I wonder, when people decide how much food they're going to put out, how they do that. Are they measuring? Are they eyeballing? Are they guessing? Are they just putting the food there and letting the animal free feed and have as much as the animal wants? And I don't know, do you think that it's actually important for people to really pay attention, try to look at the size of the animal, and is there some general recommendation about how much food that they should have, and then actually measure it?
I think that actually is a big issue, and Most pet foods, either on the packaging or on a website, will actually have a guide based on the weight of the animal and how much they should be fed per day. And then that can either be given all at once or divided out or just put down and the animal can graze, however the owner has decided to do that. But the important thing to remember is what a cup really is. Just like, you know, a standard coffee cup, a small coffee cup is actually a cup, like 6 ounces. You don't want to be using, you know, I'll be honest, I'm guilty of it myself. I use an old cup I had from college that's sort of a pretty big sized cup, and it's my cup for my dog, but I know he needs 2 cups and I know there's about 2 cups in there. So I strongly encourage people to measure at least once or twice. And then if they want to use some other thing than just a measuring cup, just figure out how much is in that vessel that they're using to pour out so they have an idea how much they're giving. A lot of people free feed their cats. Very few people free feed their dogs, I think, because dogs are sort of programmed to kind of eat whatever's put in front of them and don't really free feed that well, or they blow up like balloons. But I really encourage people to, at least when you're – and when you're – the other important thing is when you're switching to a new food, recalculate how much that animal needs, because – some of the foods have more calories, some have less calories, and your animal can suddenly begin to lose weight or gain weight, and you think it's some medical problem, and it turns out it's just because you switched the type of food, even within brands, and didn't recalculate how much of that new food they needed. If you need help in figuring out how much your pet actually needs to eat, because certainly a 20-pound beagle may need a different amount of food than a 20-pound Cavalier King Charles, because the beagle may be much more active and need more food, more calories. If you're having difficulty figuring it out, your veterinarian or one of the technicians at the vet hospital, I'm sure, would be able to help you determine that, because obviously a more active dog needs a little more than a less active dog, and they would be very willing to help you determine what you need.
And I would have to add that just like in people who are monitoring their weight, getting an accurate weight on that animal is in a timely and consistent manner is really important to assess how well or unfortunately not well you're doing with your pet's diet. You know, we do this a lot in the animals I work with the small exotic animals. They can lose body mass really quickly and put it on just as quickly. So we weigh them very frequently, and that's something that pet owners should get in the habit of doing.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine there are probably a lot of people that they take their animals to the vet, and maybe in the course of a routine exam they get weighed. But people at home probably are not weighing their animals, and there may be a lot of people that don't ever weigh themselves. They don't have a scale in the house. They just don't do that. They don't think about that. And so maybe from time to time it might not be a bad idea. Know what your baseline is, and then every once in a while put them on the scale and find out.
And it's important as well, because some people will have a general idea of how much their pet weighs, and then their pet will become ill and they will bring them into the vet and we'll weigh them, and then we'll say to the owner, how much do they usually weigh? And a lot of owners actually have a general idea of what their pet weighs, which is really great. But one of the things I would let people know is most veterinarians will let you just pop by and weigh your pet. If you just kind of are, especially if they're on a weight loss or weight gain program. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that people should not – I've had several people I've encountered who get really kind of upset when they hear somebody say your animal is heavy. And it really is not a it's not meant to be offensive. It's meant to be – you know, their weight is not your weight, and it's not meant to be criticizing the owner at all. It truly is not. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people are unaware of how, you know, they may think it's muscle and it's actually fat, or maybe the animal's activity level has changed. And so I think people need to just, you know, it's all done in the spirit of trying to do the best for the animal and keep them as healthy as possible and give their joints a break and stuff. And so they should not be, you know, they should take it as a, oh, well, maybe we can do something different, take them on more walks or change their diet or things like that.
Okay. So we're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have two guests with us, Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both clinical assistant professors in the College of Veterinary Medicine here at the U of I. They're both vets. And in addition to their interest in companion animals, Julia also is a wildlife specialist. So if you have wildlife questions, we can do that. And, of course, routine questions about companion animals, we can do that. The lines are full, so we want to get back to taking calls here, and we'll do as many as we possibly can. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a number of callers. They're all in Urbana. We'll take them in the order they came, and that means first we'll go to line number 2 right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is a bit more about ticks and fleas. I have a cat that is the subject of a flea infestation. Mainly I had a dog that died, and now the cat's the only one around, and the fleas are driving it nuts. It's taken to living in the bathroom, which is the only room that doesn't have shag carpeting. It's on Advantage. No, Frontline. It's on Frontline, and I wanted to get the comparisons between Revolution, Frontline, and Advantage. I've been told that Revolution and Advantage both only affect one stage of the flea's life, and that Frontline covers 3 of the 4. But I've also been told that Advantage and Revolution are more effective on that one stage than Frontline is on the 3. Now, I don't know if this is true, but I've gotten some various opinions. I just kind of wanted to know what you guys thought. And we'll just go with that.
Okay. Well, it's I absolutely understand how frustrating that can be when an infestation sort of hits. I feel like based on my experience, that both Frontline and Advantage are quite good as far as flea control goes. Revolution, I think, is pretty good, but one of the things about Revolution is that it does have the added protection against heartworm. We don't see a lot of it in cats, but it certainly is a risk for them in an area like here where we see a lot of mosquitoes. And so I think any of the 3 products are fine. One of the things our dermatologists actually at the vet school do a lot of work with patients with chronic flea allergies and such. And one of the things that they do is they increase the frequency of applying the medication, regardless of which one it is. And I think Frontline's one of the ones that they may do, I think, most of the time for severe flea allergies. And so going based on what I've seen them do, my feeling is that their feelings about Frontline and how good it is are probably pretty strong, that it's a good product. But I have not been dissatisfied with any of them for any of those 3 products for flea control. One of the things we will do with these severe infestations is rather than put the product on every month for something like Frontline, we'll actually go to every 2 or every 3 weeks, sort of just to make sure we have adequate amounts of it on the animal to reduce the flea infestation. So it may be something to consider going to rather than applying it once a month, to consider applying it every 3 weeks.
Well, I'm already dropped it to every 3 weeks.
Okay.
Now, it doesn't seem to be that effective. Now, I have a friend that I don't think their infestation was as bad, but they got a cat, and they swear by the Revolution. Said that within 2 doses, the fleas basically had disappeared.
Well, part of the problem is the environment as well, because you can certainly keep them off the animal, but if they're going to be in the environment, they're going to be in the environment. And so if the infestation is that bad, you may actually be in a situation where you will have to do some environmental treatment as well, in which case you would probably want to there are obviously over-the-counter products and foggers and things like that, but it may be a situation where you're going to have to treat the environment as well if the infestation is that bad, in order to really reduce the amount of flea infestation if it's in your carpet and things like that, because they're just going to continue to multiply in the environment, and treating the cat with whatever, regardless how effective it is not going to, in the end, be
just
as successful.
Temporary phase.
Yeah.
Now, one last question is about treating the environment. This house is a mess. It's been shag carpeted for ages. It's I can sweep and sweep and sweep and just always get tons of dirt out of the thing. I wouldn't doubt that if I pulled up the carpet, it would be just a field of dust and dirt. Now, what is the effectiveness of, say, bombing the house with an insecticide? Pulling all the cat and myself out of the house and bombing it and coming back after 12 hours.
You know, I guess I really don't have the expertise in that area to
Sounds
give
like
you
Noel
a good.
Is the one to talk to, maybe.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, he's the guy.
Yeah, it may be worth contacting a pest control company and finding out from them or the isn't there somebody at the entomology extension who does?
Phil, yeah, actually, he's occasionally on the show. Phil Nixon is a specialist in insect control, and you also might go through your extension person, but he's the guy that that when they have a problem that they can't deal with, then he's the guy that they call. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it sounds like you're going to have, one way or another, you're going to have to get some professional help.
Some of the recommendations that I recall from way back when, before we had Frontline, was certainly with a shag carpet to vacuum and to vacuum, you know, deeply and thoroughly, and then get rid of that vacuum bag so that you remove the eggs and the insects.
I use a sweeper that's got a water bath. So yeah. I wash the thing out, and that takes care of that part of it. All right. Well, thanks for the info.
All right. Very good. Let's go on to next caller, line 3. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
We have a black lab also who is 2 years old, loves to chew. We've bought the Nyla bones and the Kong toys, but she gets bored with those. So I'm curious about the bones or the rawhide that are available in the pet stores. What are your recommendations about those?
So some dogs don't tolerate rawhides very well. Their stomachs seem to get a little upset with them. And, you know, certainly it varies from dog to dog. The big things that I sort of think about when I'm trying to think about appropriate toys for a dog to keep them active are, one, is it an item that's large enough or that they cannot chew into small enough pieces so that they can swallow them in larger chunks where it may obstruct their esophagus? That's sort of my first major criteria. And some of the rawhides actually, as they break down, can become small enough to sort of get caught in their throat. I've actually pulled several out of dogs' throats over my career. So that's one thing you need to think about. There are the super durable Kongs and all of those sorts of things. And I agree that some dogs will get bored with them. The white sort of sterilized bones that you can buy these are not butcher bones. They're not the ones you get from the butcher, but they're ones you can buy in pet stores. They're very hard, very durable. Yes, bits of them can be broken off, but they are very small bits. So usually those are not a problem. They're oftentimes hollow. I've seen people who take like American cheese, put it inside and then microwave it so the cheese melts into the bone and then it keeps the dog busy trying to get the cheese out. You know, they actually sell things that look like they come in those spray cheese cans that you can fill the Kongs with and stuff. I personally, my dog gets the American cheese thing because it's cheaper. But it's, you know, things like that I think are very good. There are different grades of sort of the Nylabone style chew things for heavy chewers, light chewers, that kind of thing. The big thing is I err on the side of going for something that is more durable because I do not want anything to be swallowed inappropriately. And so I do not recommend ever having rawhides given to an animal without supervision, though. I always worry about that. So if your dog gets a rawhide, I would definitely make sure to do it when somebody is around the dog and can watch. And if there are smaller pieces that she chews off and looks like they may be big enough or small enough to swallow, to pick those up and throw them away.
And you mentioned – oh, excuse me.
Sure.
You mentioned butcher bones, and you're not advocating those, correct?
I think some of the heavier chewers can split them pretty easily. Now, if you have a dog who's not a heavy chewer, you've got a smaller dog who doesn't have as much jaw strength, I don't think it's as much of an issue. I do worry with some of the dogs that are heavy chewers and have a lot of jaw strength that they will split those bones, and then you end up with bits and pieces that they can – now bigger chunks that they can swallow and potentially cause damage. That's what I worry about.
It is good to give them things to stimulate the chewing and to give them these things, correct?
Right, it is, absolutely. Yeah. And I have no objection to that. I think it's a good activity for them. It keeps them busy. Some dogs actually are calmed by the chewing. I do think if you have a dog who really is tearing stuff up, though, I know it's probably something that, you know, everybody says, but lots of exercise, you know, get them out, do more exercise, get more walks, more playtime, more throwing the ball, that kind of stuff, because it's really Dogs that are very destructive with their toys tend to be dogs that are not getting quite as much activity as they need for the stage of life they're in, and that may be something that can help.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Right, very good. Let's go on. And next is line four. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling about a Boston Terrier that I have. He's about 8 years old, and I believe he has a food allergy of some sort, but I'm not positive about it. We've tried changing his food a few different times. I've even given him a home-cooked diet. And when I give him the home-cooked diet, it seems like the allergies go away. And by allergies, I mean red ears, licking of the paws, sometimes vomiting.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I give him the home-cooked diet, rice and meat and vegetables, those problems seem to go away. But when I do that, I'm worried about the nutrients that I'm giving him. And it's also time-consuming. So I'm wondering if there's a suggestion that you have for food for him that I can purchase that would maybe take care of an allergy, perhaps to corn or wheat or something of that nature.
So food allergies are a very common problem in dogs. And many times when we have patients that have specific that we feel may have a food allergy, what we'll do is put them on what we call a novel protein, novel carbohydrate diet, or put them on what we call a hydrolyzed diet. Those are diets. The novel protein, novel carb diets are diets where there is one protein source and there's one carbohydrate source and very limited additives. So it would be something like lamb and rice was sort of the original one, but now it's such a ubiquitous food that we tend to move away from that. But there's things like duck or venison or kangaroo even, or fish diets, things that are protein sources they have not been exposed to before so that they probably do not have an allergy to it. And then the carbohydrate source is something like oats or green peas or potato, a carbohydrate source that is also novel and new to their body. And a lot of the sort of sensitive skin diets and sensitive stomach diets are fine for the majority of them. But if you have a dog who has a true allergy like that, then one of these specialized novel protein, novel carbohydrate diets would be best. There are several companies that make them. They are generally available through veterinarians. So I would contact your vet about putting the dog on one of those diets, and you should be – they come in both canned and dry varieties, and there are several different options you would have available to you. Now, many of these diets do take about 4 to 6 weeks at the minimum to really show obvious effect, but they work very well in patients that have significant skin-related food allergies.
Okay, and those are long-term solutions.
Yes,
for that
they
issue.
Can be on that. They're nutritionally complete. They can be on them for life.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
You're very
thanks.
Welcome.
That just real quick, that maybe might be worth mentioning. Obviously, this caller knows it, but that for dogs, the way that they express their allergies is through their skin.
A lot of times, yes.
A lot of times. So if there are times when the dog seems clearly their skin is irritating and they're doing a lot of chewing and licking and stuff like that, that may in fact, the root cause may in fact be some kind of allergy, maybe not necessarily food, but I suppose that they can have some of the same kind of allergies that humans do.
Yes, absolutely. Licking of the paws, ears, recurrent ear infections, you know, scratching at the ears. Flea allergies tend to manifest in the area over sort of the back part of sort of the base of the tail right above their back. That's kind of an area where we see a lot of itching there. And, you know, they definitely manifest a lot of allergic skin problems. Our dermatology service is quite busy.
Yeah. We have about 5-6 minutes left, a couple of other calls. We'll try to get them both next. Urbana line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Another weight problem with a dog. I now use a measuring cup. The vet suggested I reduce his food by a half a cup, and he did lose 13 pounds.
Oh.
A lot. And now I think when we went to the vet med dog wash, they gave him a 5, which I guess is not too bad. They said they rated dog's weight a 1 to 9, and he was a 5. But he's just ravenous all the time. And I wondered if there was any kind of food that maybe had bulk to it. Right now he's on just Purina dog chow and the regular kind, and he's 8 years old, a mixed medium-sized mixed breed dog. Is there anything that will fill him up? I feed him the three-quarters of a cup twice a day, but he just acts like he's starving to death all the time.
There are several things you can do. One very simple thing is to maybe give them carrots as treats, or the little baby carrots you can buy in the grocery store. Things like that are very good treats for dogs. Most dogs like the taste of carrots. They're an easy thing that adds few calories. It does have some nutrients, and it's going to sort of bulk up. You can chop them up and add them to the food as a bulking agent. There are also foods out there that are lower calorie foods. And, you know, there's the over-the-counter brands like Fit and Trim, or many of the over-the-counter foods will have like a weight management diet, and those tend to be bulkier. They tend to have a lot more fiber in them and sort of help keep the animal a little more full. So maybe switching to a weight management diet is a good idea because it does have a little more bulk and may keep him full for a little bit longer. We do grade companion animals on a scale of 1 to 9, 9 being very obese and 1 being essentially emaciated. 4 to 5 is sort of where we like to see most of our patients, and 5 being a titch on the heavier side, 4 being a titch on the lighter side. But really, so if your dog is a 5, that's an excellent, you know, it sounds like you've done a really good job to get his weight down, and I'm sure long term it's going to be wonderful for his joints and things like that. But there are certainly some options for you to fill his stomach up a bit more.
Would the directions on the package of Fit and Trim, I don't, since he's doing so well on the measurement that I'm giving him now, I wonder how I know what to give him, except for running off to the vet to weigh him. Would that be the only way I would tell how much to give them of the new food?
Yeah, most of those packages will actually say how much to give them based on their current weight, and they'll give you options. Are if you're trying to get them to lose weight, it'll have one amount, or if you're trying to maintain a weight, it'll have another amount.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, one more caller here, Shelbyville, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to say what a wonderful clinic you have. I've had animals at Bolting Wildlife, and my young dog had both her knees rebuilt with you folks, and you're absolutely wonderful. Place to be. I have a 7.5-pound Cavapoo, and she is the one who had her knees rebuilt. She's 2 now, and we walk probably 2 miles in the morning and 2 miles in the afternoon. And my question is when is too much exercise too much?
You know, I guess that's not a question we have to deal with very often, to be honest with you, and it's actually something I'd like to hear more. I think that I go by the dog, and you're obviously going to know your dog better than anybody else. So if you feel that he or she – is it she?
She
is getting tired, or she's really starting to drag towards the end of the walk, that kind of thing, then, you know, that's obviously an indication that you know, you need to shorten it a little bit for her. And obviously, as she ages, you're going to see changes in her ability to handle long walks. But I feel that, you know, exercise and walking is very good for the joints and very good to keep their weight down. And it also, I think, is just good for their attitude and for their quality of life, because they get out, they get to go smell things and meet other dogs and bond with you a little bit. So I actually encourage as much exercise as the dog is comfortable doing. If you feel that she's starting to get out of breath or really slow down after, you know, a certain portion in the walk, or just absolutely flops down exhausted when you get back, you know, that might be an indication to cut back a little bit. But if she's still up for it, I say go ahead.
Great. Okay. Well, if every now and then she'll just sort of stop and look at me like, come on. So I just pick her up. Pick her up and carry her for a while, and then and she wriggles and wipes down, so we keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fine. And, you know, the other thing is you want to make sure she has plenty of water available when she gets back, you know, so she can rehydrate. And in hotter weather, especially, even stopping and bringing a bottle of water in one of those little collapsible bowls just to allow her a little bit of a drink halfway along, especially in real hot weather, if that's
something you feel
is useful. So
I take a bottle of water with me, so she gets, you know, when she'll stop, she gets water.
Good, good.
Well, That's great. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, we have maybe about a minute or two left here. I don't know if there's anything in particular on either of your minds that you just might want to have a chance and mention.
Well, I guess we do have cold weather coming. So just kind of remember there are a few kind of points that I like to, you know, make sure people understand is that if you have pets that are primarily outdoors, that they have a shelter that is out of the wind and dry and clean. Some people put straw as an insulator in a doghouse or extra blankets or things like that, but just to make sure the area is clean and dry and out of the wind if they're an outdoor animal. And that the animal's water sources are not frozen as we start to get into, you know, really cold weather, that their water bowls are always flowing and that kind of thing. And that, you know, some people bring their indoor cats in or at least reduce their time outside or their outdoor cats in and reduce their time outside during the winter. And, you know, just kind of being aware of those things. Most of the snow melter or ice melting compounds nowadays are less irritating to dogs' feet, but some of them definitely are. So if you're going to walk your dog in areas where there is snow melt or ice melt chemicals, to I usually just take a damp rag after walks and just wipe down the bottoms of their feet just to make sure that I get kind of some of that residue off. Mm. It's not going to hurt them so much as it can be irritating to the skin. Yeah. And, you know, just make sure that ears and tail tips and noses and such are kept warm enough that, you know, they're not going to get a little frostbite. Yeah. And just make sure they're protected. So.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that this morning, about the foot issue, because there happened to be an article in this morning's newspaper actually about runners, human runners, who run barefoot. Mm. Which to me sounds sort of crazy, but then I'm thinking, well, of course the animals, they're made that way. But you do also have to think about the fact that, yeah, there can be things that can irritate their pads, and you want to be careful about that. Particularly, I would think in the wintertime that you would have some of those same kind of issues. Mm-hmm. Well, at that, I guess we'll pretty much finish up with our thanks to our two guests here, Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both clinical assistant professors at the U of I College of Vet Medicine, and occasionally they're here. We talk about companion animals, and the you're open to people's questions at any time or most
Absolutely.
Times?
Absolutely. Yep. If anybody has any questions, they can contact us at the College of Veterinary Medicine Small Animal Clinic.
Yeah. And whether this is a question about their companion animals or also we talk a little bit about wild animals at the beginning, if they have any sorts of question about an injured animal, they can call you?
You bet. The Wildlife Clinic is available to receive animals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we're always happy to answer questions.
All right. Hey, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It.